Didn't you have enough confidence in Ray Berger to tell him the whole story? I don't trust anyone, not even myself. Are you keeping quiet to protect American or German personnel? I cannot answer. I am honest. Someday I want my family to know that I died an honorable man who loved his country. The officers called it a day. Immediately upon his return to camp, Lieutenant Young testified. He had none of Heisig's assurance. Responding slowly under the prompting of Major Fuller, he told the panel that the prisoner, Carl Heisig, inspected all mail sent out of the hospital by German patients and workers, and saw to it that letters were properly addressed, correctly folded, and packaged for the postal authorities. Heisig also functioned apparently as an unofficial censor, making sure that the letters contained no prohibited information. The adjutant said Heisig had the freedom of the entire hospital, confidential files accepted, and frequently went from one office to another in the performance of his duties. Young said that he was often away from his own office. Mail and other documents were sometimes placed on his desk by error, he said, and on such occasions it became his responsibility to feed them back into the proper channels. Skipping down, Major Fuller seized the first opportunity to interrupt him, waving away more elaborate explanations. Quote, Lieutenant Young, he said, I hand you this paper marked Exhibit A, the notes, and ask you to look at it carefully, read it, and state for the record whether or not you gave this document to Feldwebel Carl Heisig. Young, perspiring and flushed pink to the roots of his steel-gray hair, stared at the paper for a while and said flatly, I have no knowledge of ever seeing this before. While not strictly responsive, the statement was clear enough. It was the last we were to hear from or of the lieutenant. He was whisked away to another assignment, and his name was never mentioned again in my presence. Astonishingly, Heisig, too, vanished at this juncture. He was transferred to another jurisdiction before he could be questioned again, and the trail of the document that had triggered the mess hall killing stopped with him. It had appeared one day in his hands, and he had handed it to Beyer. That was all we ever surely knew. Okay, before we go on, let me just point this out again, exactly what's going on here. Apparently, at some point, the document crossed Lieutenant Young, the American's, desk, and went into the hands of Carl Heisig, this medical soldier, as he calls himself, who was a German prisoner, essentially, and had a great deal of freedom within the operation of the prison camp to censor other prisoners' mail, to inspect their mail, and often having access to things in other people's offices. So at some point, not only was this particular bit of documentation important for the prosecution of a murder on American soil, but in fact it also was suggestive of an entire way of dealing with things in these prison camps that could have used some looking into. But in fact, as the author points out, not only the American lieutenant but the German were both whisked out of the jurisdiction of the investigation and were never questioned any more on the matter.
Now, right after this point in the testimony, which again, a obviously pro-Hitler German, a member of the Nazi Party, was allowed to censor all of the other inmates' mail as a result of the information which he admittedly communicated to the other Germans, a man was murdered. The American officer who allowed this kind of behavior is in no way involved in the investigation, and the trail stops. Eventually, five Germans were executed for the five German POWs for the murder of Kunz. But at this point, the prosecution basically was expanded. A person was brought in to oversee the course of the prosecution from this point, and this particular individual did not pursue either Officer Young or Heisig or the main connection in the case, which was why the Germans, the pro-Nazi Germans, were allowed basically to run these camps like they were their own little fiefdoms. And this special prosecutor is a person whose name we've come across in the past.
And interestingly enough, this involvement of this person we're going to be talking about was roughly coincident with the decision on the part of somebody in the United States Armed Forces to suddenly put the lid on this trial and make it secret. In other words, to ban the press and ban any kind of spectators or things of that nature. So what was basically a fairly simple matter of a murder in a prison camp became apparently enough of an embarrassment or a worry at some levels that it was made a secret trial. Anyway, reading again from the Parnell and Tabor book. At this point, Lieutenant Colonel Leon Jaworski of the Judge Advocate General's Office in Dallas entered the case. I saw at once that I was nowhere near the finish line. For the moment, frustration engulfed me. I was sick of Blut und Geschlagen. Jaworski's quiet confidence was a quick restorative. All I knew of him at the time came from Fuller's description, quote, a crackin' good trial lawyer from Texas before he came to the Army, unquote. Skipping along, although an interpreter was present at all times, the, quote, crackin' good trial lawyer from Texas, unquote, dealt with the witnesses directly, speaking a fluent German, which he later told me he had picked up as a child. Skipping on. The judge advocate remarks on a prosecution, this is at the end of the trial, the judge advocate remarks on a prosecution, quote, brilliantly and masterfully conducted by Jaworski and Fuller, and also praises the prosecutors for their commendable restraint and for having been, quote, faithful to their responsibilities to produce all of the evidence irrespective of its effect, unquote. Well, as we saw, they certainly didn't produce much more evidence on Young and Heisig, since both of them were allowed to leave before the interrogations were finished and then moved out of the jurisdiction. Skipping on down, in his closing remarks, Jaworski says he has never before appeared in a court anywhere in which so much consideration was given to the facts of the case. Again, one has to wonder about that, if that's a slightly ironic statement, or if that's really true, what kind of cases was Jaworski involved in before? Quote, I am happy over it, he adds, because when this court writes its findings in this matter, it will come as the result of painstaking consideration of the evidence that has been presented, so that everyone knows, no matter who he is, no matter where he may be, that these accused have gotten the fair, impartial trial they are entitled to under the laws of this land. Well, interesting, and the commendable restraint that Leon Jaworski showed here, as we have talked about earlier in the show, crop up later on when, among other things, he's involved in Watergate, which, as Dave and I both suggested in our own personal opinions, perhaps was not prosecuted with quite the commendable lack of restraint that might have been necessary to have done something besides pardon Richard Nixon and cover the rest of the thing up.
In between his commendable restraint in prosecuting the Coons trial and Watergate, Jaworski went from the Coons trial, incidentally, to Nuremberg, and those who have listened to these shows for some time know about the commendable restraint that the Nuremberg prosecutors also used, since many of the defendants in those trials wound up working for our national security establishment. And after that, well, he then went to work for, among other things, an organization called the M.D. Anderson Fund, of which he was a member of the board of directors, which was a CIA domestic funding conduit. He then served as special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, investigating the JFK assassination for the state of Texas, also did the same thing for the Warren Commission, and specifically was in charge with seeing whether Lee Harvey Oswald had any intelligence connections. Connections between, of course, the JFK assassination and Watergate we talked about in Radio Era in Guns of November number 3. And following Watergate special prosecutor, he then jumps ahead and becomes special prosecutor for the Koreagate scandal, in which the Unification Church and its role as a front for the Korean CIA and its role in that behalf in the United States were front and center. Now, jumping back once again to the Watergate hearings, did you want to say something? Oh, I thought I saw one of a hand signal there. Research credit for this final item here, talking about Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski's commendable restraint. Reading now from Book 11 of the Hearings Before the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, that is the Watergate and Related Activities hearing. This is popularly known as the Watergate Committee. Reading now from Phase 2 of their hearings, from the hearings that were held on October 4th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 31st of 1973. This is from Book 11, and again, the research credit here goes to Mae Brussel. And from the Watergate transcripts, we find an interesting exchange here between Senator Talmadge of the Senate Watergate Committee and a Mr. Benz, B-E-N-Z, who was an employee of the so-called Dirty Tricks Unit of the Nixon White House employed by Donald Segretti. Talmadge says here, I believe you two had subordinates. One was named Mr. Duke and the other was named Mr. Hearing. Is that right? Mr. Benz. His nickname was Duke. I do not believe that was his last name. Talmadge. One was named Duke and the other Hearing? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Did Mr. Hearing tell you that this man Duke was a former SS officer for Adolf Hitler's stormtroopers? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Did you believe that? Benz. No, sir. Talmadge. Did Duke ever tell you that? Benz. I do not recall if he ever did or not. Talmadge. Did you feel that being trained by Adolf Hitler and his stormtroopers particularly qualified him for the duties that you assigned him to? Benz. I do not know of any training school that would train him for this work. Talmadge. I could not hear you. Mr. Benz, I said I do not know of any training school that would train a person for this type of work. Talmadge. Were not the activities quite similar? Did not Hitler's Nazi stormtroopers perform similar activities to what you were engaged in Florida? Benz. I would not know that, Senator. Talmadge. You have read some history of that period, have you not? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Have you read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, I take it? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Are not the activities of the Nazi stormtroopers somewhat similar? Benz. I do not recall if he ever did or not. That, of course, in the context that he replied. Talmadge. I thought they were. I read about a good many falsified documents during that era and libels and slander about the opposition. It was one of the ways, as I recall, that Adolf Hitler achieved power. Do you think Duke carried on his activities in an exemplary fashion in that manner, do you? Benz. Yes, sir. Talmadge. No further questions, Mr. Chairman. So again, that's from part of the Watergate hearings that you didn't hear publicly, that didn't look quite so neat on television. And of course, Watergate special prosecutor Leon Jaworski of the CIA showed a due to commendable restraint, as some might phrase it, in not taking up this as well as the many other aspects of the Watergate question that we've come across in the past. Recall that Nixon's Nazi connections were the subject of considerable discussion in Radio Free America show number 2. That concludes the prepared portion of the broadcast.
It does indeed. And what we're going to jump to next is a discussion of the other counsel who was appointed along with Leon Jaworski to serve as special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry. Now, once again, that body was the Texas state body appointed by then Texas State Attorney General Wagner Carr to investigate the assassination of President Kennedy. They did a less than vigorous job. And the conclusions of the Texas Court of Inquiry were similar to the conclusions that were reached by the Warren Commission. Now, I've cited Leon Jaworski's political pedigree, going from his commendable restraint that he showed in not pursuing the American officers who were complicit in communicating into information about Corporal Kunz, which led to his demise. Note also that Leon Jaworski spoke fluent German as well. After that, Leon Jaworski went to Nuremberg, specifically to the doctor's trial, the euthanasia trial, where the prosecutors in general showed commendable restraint in not going after the German eugenicists who had drawn heavily from American eugenics legislation as well as intellectual creation, and who had also used the approval for the German eugenics program on the by American eugenicists to generate propaganda in order to convince their critics at home and abroad that they were on the right track. Note Leon Jaworski's subsequent involvement with the intelligence community, or perhaps involvement with the intelligence community at that point. As mentioned in that segment of the archive show that you heard, he was a member of the board of directors of the MD Anderson Fund. Later went on to become, again, Warren Commission counsel, special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, later Watergate special prosecutor, and eventually, of course, the Koreagate special prosecutor, again, downplaying the intelligence connections of the Unification Church, which, as we saw on Radio Free America number 7, has its genesis with Japanese fascism in World War II and some strong connections between people involved with the Japanese patriotic or ultra-nationalist societies and the Unification Church. One of the questions that I have, and it's the question raised by our examination of history under the circumstances, is just how deep some of the deep politics that was characterized by Peter Dale Scott in his recent book, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, actually go. I ask that question because a piece of research done by a listener has cast the behavior of Leon Jaworski, both with regard to the killing of Corporal Kunz and with regard to Nuremberg, and later with regard to the assassination of President Kennedy, which, as we've seen in numerous archive shows, involved fascists both from the United States and from Europe, elements associated with the former World Anti-Communist Leagues and the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. An important element of that were involved with one aspect or another of the assassination of President John Kennedy. We looked at that in the Guns of November Part 4 in the aforementioned Aryan Nations broadcast in Radio Free America number 15 and in the July 26th, August 2nd, and August 30th, 1992 installments of Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. Now bear in mind Leon Jaworski's role with regard to the Kunz trial as well as the doctor's trial at Nuremberg. In both cases, the prosecution was weak and deliberately overlooked the complicity of Americans in Nazi crimes. In the case of Corporal Kunz, the murder of a lone Wehrmacht prisoner of war. In the case of the doctor's trial, the murder of thousands of people. And under intellectual and legal auspices, which drew heavily on American counterparts. The other counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, now bear in mind again, this was investigating or, quote, investigating, unquote, the assassination of John F. Kennedy on behalf of the state of Texas. The other special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry was a fellow named Robert G. Story, S-T-O-R-E-Y. In a report to Governor John Connally, by then Texas State Attorney General Wagner Carr, there is a description of the work of the Texas Court of Inquiry. In that letter, and this, by the way, was in the report to Governor Connally, this was extracted by a listener. It reads, "My special counsel, Mr. Leon Jaworski, former president of the State Bar of Texas, Houston, and Dean Robert G. Story, former president of the American Bar Association, Dallas, have prominently participated in the preparation of this report and approve it as herein presented above. Finally, I wish to say to you that we and all Texans owe a deep debt of gratitude to the two distinguished members of the State Bar who so unselfishly answered my request for assistance as special counsel in this investigation. Mr. Leon Jaworski and Dean Robert G. Story have given many hours of their time. Without their invaluable counsel and assistance, our work could not have been so thorough nor complete." Well, their work was neither thorough nor complete, as we have seen. Now, we're going to note here Robert Story and a piece of his background. Now, again, research credit on this belongs to a listener. Robert Story also had a life story, no pun intended, which crossed the turf of Nuremberg, Germany, and the Nuremberg trials. The listener who researched this connection for us found the following in volume 34 of Who's Who in America, the 1966-1967 edition, put out by Marcus Who's Who Incorporated, Marcus M-A-R-Q-U-I-S. And in this particular description of the career of Robert Gerald Story, S-T-O-R-E-Y, it lists his various duties in the legal community and notes the following. Served as United States, now this is the same Robert Story who served along with Leon Jaworski, another Nuremberg prosecutorial veteran. Robert G. Story was the other counsel for the Texas Court of Inquiry, and it notes the following about Robert Story. Served as United States Executive Trial Counsel to Justice Robert H. Jackson in Nuremberg Trial of Major War Criminals 1945-46. And again, notes the president of the Dallas Bar Association, etc., etc. This is the same Robert Story who served with Leon Jaworski. Now, of Robert Story's behavior in the Nuremberg trials, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in the book The Splendid Blonde Beast. This, by the way, researched for us by that same listener. Christopher Simpson's book, The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, was published in hardcover by the Grove Press of New York and copyrighted 1993. And on page 247, we find the following about the behavior of Colonel Robert Story with regard to the Nuremberg trials. Now, the discussion here concerns the relaxation of the denazification directive, and as we have seen in numerous archive shows, the denazification of Germany was essentially a farce, and the Nuremberg trials themselves, although doing away with a few of the more obvious and obnoxious elements of Nazism, were themselves something of a whitewash. And Colonel Robert Story also shows some judicial restraint here as the executive trial counsel to the International Military Tribunal. Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast. Colonel Robert Story, S-T-O-R-E-Y, the U.S. Executive Trial Counsel at the International Military Tribunal and a senior aide to Robert Jackson, had, quote, passed the word down that the denazification directive was to be relaxed, unquote. Aufinger continued, that's a fellow who was arguing against the rigorous enforcement of the denazification provisions. So now this rumor mongering here is noted by Christopher Simpson. Sympathetic U.S. officers promulgated this, quote, relaxation, unquote, largely by word of mouth during the summer of 1945. But this rumor network had considerable effect. The hardline U.S. officers targeted in Aufinger's attack resigned before the year was out, despite the fact that it was their position in the denazification debate, not Aufinger's, that the President of the United States had publicly endorsed at Potsdam, excuse me. Colonel Robert Story, the U.S. Executive Trial Counsel at the International Military Tribunal and a senior aide to Robert Jackson, had, quote, passed the word down that the denazification directive was to be relaxed, unquote. Aufinger continued. Now, again, I think the Nuremberg legacy of people like Leon Jaworski and Robert Story raises many more questions than it answers in terms of, for example, an examination of the Nazi connections to the assassination of John Kennedy. One of those questions that it raises, and I do not pretend to have the answer, and I want to stress that very clearly, is just how deep some of the deep politics involved in the JFK assassination actually goes. To what extent might the selection of people like Leon Jaworski and Robert Story, first of all, to serve at Nuremberg, and then perhaps later with bodies purportedly investigating the Kennedy assassination, to what extent might their selection have been determined by the belief, an accurate one, or by the record, of their having been soft on the American connections to fascism? This, again, is not a statement I'm making, but rather a question I'm asking, because it is certainly interesting and possibly significant that Leon Jaworski and Robert Story had both been involved with the Nuremberg prosecutions, Jaworski with a very lax prosecution of the German doctors and their eugenicist counterparts, and as we've seen, they drew heavily on their American contacts, both for the laws that they drew up as well as for the propagandistic justification of same. Robert Story helping to pass down the word that the denazification laws were to be relaxed at Nuremberg, and they most assuredly were. Later, we find them both assisting Wagner Carr in the investigation of the Texas Court of Inquiry, which mirrored the preposterous results of the Warren Commission's, quote, investigation, unquote. And as we have seen in numerous archive shows, at the core of President Kennedy's assassination was a fascist milieu involving American national security, political, industrial, and financial figures, as well as alumni of the fascist powers of Europe. We've looked at elements like the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, elements that later coalesced into the World Anti-Communist League, and their role in the John F. Kennedy assassination, largely one of helping to generate and traffic around the myth of Oswald the KGB operative, something we'll come back to, by the way, next week. We've taken a look at the Nazi and ABN connections to John Kennedy's assassination in the Guns of November Part 4, the aforementioned Aryan Nation series, Radio Free America 15, as well as the 726, 82, and 830 installments of how the United States lost the Second World War, Radio Free America 37. And again, I'm taking a look at the American eugenicists' complicity in the crimes of the Third Reich, because those eugenicists' views, I think, are going to be coming into play in a big, big way in the event of an economic collapse in the United States. Note again the fluctuation of the dollar. Note the brouhaha about gun control. We're going to come back to the gun control issue next week, because I don't think we're going to have time to do justice to that this evening. But remember the Nuremberg connection, because we're going to be coming back to another individual who served on the U.S. prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg, namely former U.S. Senator from Connecticut, Thomas Dodd, an individual who figures prominently in the history not only of the American complicity for German fascism, but also an individual who crops up in the context of the disinformation campaign about Oswald as a KGB operative linked to Bogdan Stashinsky. He crops up in the context of the former World Anti-Communist League or associates of it, such as the American Security Council. And Thomas Dodd also was instrumental in the 1968 U.S. gun control law, which a number of firearms industry and right-wing critics have charged was modeled on a 1938 Third Reich law. That is an hypothesis I am neither endorsing nor criticizing. I do not have the tools at my disposal to verify whether those allegations are correct. I have seen the American law and the German text that it purports to be based on. Unfortunately, I just don't have enough German to go through that massive document and make the appropriate criticisms or to note the correspondence, if indeed there is correspondence as alleged. We will be getting into that next week. But note, again, the fluctuation of the dollar. Note, again, America's precarious financial position. Note the viewpoints of people associated with the Pioneer Fund, the same views on race that led to the Nazi extermination programs. Note the recurring presence throughout modern American history of people like Leon Jaworski and Robert Story, individuals who were complicit with covering up the elements of fascist criminal wrongdoing. In the case of Robert Story and Leon Jaworski, they were less than vigorous in their pursuit of the truth concerning the Kennedy assassination, and both, along with a great many others, bear some responsibility for the lax nature of the Nuremberg prosecutions. Again, as I have noted, fascism is not something alien to the United States. Many of our most prominent industrialists and financiers were openly and wholeheartedly pro-fascist. The cream of the Nazi intelligence system and defense industry were incorporated right into the United States national security establishment at the end of World War II. And as we have seen this evening, as well as in the original miscellaneous archive show about euthanasia in contemporary America and Nazi Germany, many of the intellectual foundations for the Nazi extermination programs were rooted in the United States, and that many American eugenicists and elements that funded American eugenics, such as the Pioneer Fund, were very supportive of the Nazi racial policies. The last item that I'm going to cover during the prepared portion of tonight's program comes from the latest issue of Covert Action Quarterly. This is the spring 1994 installment of Covert Action Quarterly. It's number 48. Covert Action Quarterly can be obtained from 1500 Massachusetts Avenue. That's 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, number 732, Washington, D.C., 20005.